Pharaoh's Egypt, the land that the slaves left, and just some of the characteristics, who owns and who controls. It's what we call the big deals. I like that word. Just the big deals. You know, remember our triangle, God was up here, and then the big deals are up here, and you keep going down until you get to the slaves, and then the priests over here blessing the whole system. Oh, no wings. And if that doesn't work, over here you have the military enforcing the thing that the priests, the word of the priests and the word of religion in Pharaoh's Egypt is this is the way it always has been, is, and always will be. And thereby religion serves a wonderful purpose in the Egypt way. And so the big deals are those who own and control. The purpose of life is both to have that control and also related to having the biggest pile of possessions. A definite understanding, the higher up here, the more you deserve, and therefore the more you get. The lower you are in the triangle, the less you deserve, and therefore the less you have available to you until, you know, at the bottom is starvation. I'll compare them as I go. Over here in the manna way, God owns all. Instead of control, God gives to all. To God, you open your hand and you satisfy the desire of every living thing. Over here is piling up. Over here is a life of sufficiency. The manna in the wilderness, enough for all. The larger families have more, smaller families have less, and given to all, and it's grace. There's no word in the manna story about some deserving or how worthy anyone is. Over here, work is to pile it up. Work here is for the neighbor. I like to say that it's kind of imposing Luther's understanding of work back to the wilderness, but it's not bad. Work is for the neighbor, it's for the community. They go out and gather the manna so everyone in the community has two quarts. There's no Sabbath here, there wouldn't be any need for a Sabbath. There's Sabbath here is that wonderful day of recognition that God owns all, and God provides enough in 6 days, so, you know, relax. Relax. And then religion here is to preserve the status quo here. Worship is a wonderful times of thanksgiving to a God who provides for the needs of all, and a God who gathers a community together and binds it together in mercy and in justice. We ended our discussion here that in Pharaoh's Egypt society, for some, every day is a feast day because you have piles of food. And over here, the dream of the manna society is a life of simplicity with food. But as Israel lives its life, wonderful days of feasting for everyone. Over here, manna is life. It's the very purpose of life is to have the control and the power. So you have more manna, and some people have less, and that is what defines your worth. So this is a system of point keeping, and this is a way of grace. A manna on this side is what sustains what life really is. Manna is the gift of God to sustain what life really is, and that is friendship. Friendship with God, with others in community, and with nature. Do not muzzle the ox that treadeth on the grain. Friendship with the animals. And back to Sabbath, no Sabbath here, but Sabbath, the wonderful gift of God, in that you don't have to work all the time and you can practice fully and completely one day what life really is and what manna sustains, and that is friendship with God and others and creation. And nature. Well, that's a review, and that wasn't too long. wife tells me that my reviews are usually 3/4 of the class. I have one other picture, and this picture is helpful. Is anybody figuring out I'm kind of a visual person? I like this image. Here is God, who is the giver. God is the giver, and God pours out the manna. Remember, as the people entered the land, land then is the manna, the gift of God to provide. So God pours out the manna. And then here is a community. These will become people praising, worshiping, receiving. And there's a sense of all who are partners. And then all share and all have enough. Now, yesterday we talked about the time of the kings and Solomon and the division of the kingdom and the time when the fears of old Samuel and the fears of those original anti-king people came true. And Solomon and his elites begin to take over and turn it into a Pharaoh's Egypt kind of a society. And then as a division of the kingdom and the kings in the north and the kings in the south, the increase of injustice. And rather than the manna way of life and the wonderful and the blessed prophets calling and calling as voices of God, come back to the covenant. Meaning come back to the manna way, the way of joy, the way of blessedness for the community. I have one description of what happens as manna society changes. Here's all the gifts of God poured out for all, and then you end up with one part of society. Have to start over. They build kind of, I call it the big funnel. And then I call this the big mouth. Okay, then here's all those who are left out, to whom God has given the manna and called for a society of mercy and of righteousness to share the manna. And now a wall has to be built. But these people can be so good. It's what they do. Maybe I need to say we. You build a little faucet here. Do you get it? This is called charity. Charity in the kind of contemporary sense of the word.
Trickle-down theory.
Yeah, or the trickle-down theory. Okay. And there's a faucet. Handle on the faucet? Yeah. But that's always on this side. So who is in control of that? It's always on this side. Some gets through because God tries so hard. Does that ever happen? We talked yesterday about the covenant life and the blessedness of the covenant life. And then we moved up to the time of the New Testament. And I think a very, very brief review at the time of the coming of Jesus, that this kind of Egypt society was intact. This kind of a society, the Roman Empire and its system had really assured this kind of society, and it meant that the Palestine that Jesus came to was a Palestine where the Roman rule and its taxation system had favored the rich And by favoring the rich in that society, it meant they could take over the land of the poor and the land of other people and add house to house and field to field. And we know that from the teaching of Jesus. How much of the teaching of Jesus is about absentee landowners? The owner was off in a far country and appointed stewards. And to visualize this, you have to think of that you're a poor person in Palestine at the time of Jesus. And you would walk by the land that was your inheritance from generation to generation and biblically understood to be the manna that God gives for providing for your family. Because of the harsh taxation system, you've lost that land and it's been added to the vast field of an absentee landowner, and you walk by that land and you remember the promises of God and the inheritance of God in the manna society. And because of losing this, you are either a tenant farmer or a day laborer. And if you're a day laborer, you are living on the very, very edge that if you don't have daily work, you do not have food for tomorrow. The Lord's Prayer, the prayer of the poor, give us tomorrow's bread today. Probably the most accurate translation. Give us tomorrow's bread today. Stories of that time, of a neighborhood of poor people, of landless day laborers, and the families who received work for a day would share their food for tomorrow with the families who did not. Give us tomorrow our bread. Living on the edge and sharing that bread. And at the same time, more and more wealth in the hands of those who were rich and powerful, and the landowners. We have Pharaoh's Egypt society. Now, a question, what kind of a book is the New Testament? Books have been written about that, but I'm going to put it in two little pictures. Or the difference or the relationship of Old Testament and New Testament. And this is our normal way of saying it, and in Jewish Christian dialogues I've discovered it's much more sensitive to say Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. One way of comparing the two is to say the Hebrew Bible is about the building of a society of justice and mercy. God calling the society out of Egypt. God gathering the society. God nurturing the society. God letting this society bring judgment upon itself. God bringing the society back, always with the dream of a society of justice and mercy. Okay, then the main purpose of this society for the New Testament is that out of this society will come the Messiah, who then dies on the cross so believers will go to heaven. So the purpose of the God shedding tears and working and struggling and prophets and all through the generations was to keep a society together out of which Jesus could be born to die on the cross so believers in Jesus could go to heaven when they die. Now, what this does is it makes an absolute break between the theme of the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Hebrew Bible, the calling together of a society, the Christian Bible, how to go to heaven. Do you feel kind of a... Has this ever been taught? And I think I mentioned this last week, but taking a confirmation class to a Jewish synagogue once in Albuquerque, and A lot of our students ask the rabbi, what is the difference between Judaism and Christianity? It's one of these kind of bright, kind of like Jerry can come from it. Didn't you tell us that you were the one that asking the hard questions? Well, this one I let the rabbi field. His answer was, you know, I wouldn't agree with it, but it's what we had taught him. His answer was, Judaism teaches us how to live together on this earth, and Christianity teaches people how to go to heaven when they die. Next question. that was the idea that we had communicated to him. Now, the other relationship that I'm going to talk about tonight and tomorrow morning, it better be morning because I'm leaving. It's one of those wonderful times to teach and jump on the bus. What can I say? Would be, again, to say God calls together a society of justice and mercy. And now let's fill this out a little more. Built on the promise to Abraham and Sarah that all nations will be blessed. Or the wonderful vision of Micah and Isaiah of the people keeping the covenant way, keeping the manna way, and the nations of the world tired of war, tired of their alienation, tired of their greed, tired of their separation, will look up there to Mount Zion and say, wow, look how those people live. Shalom. Let's go over there and ask them how. Well, the dream of the prophets is that day when the nations will stream to Jerusalem and will say, teach us the way of your God. And then the dream goes, then the nations will beat their swords into plowshares. And each person will sit under their tree and be safe with no one to harm them. Because then all the nations will be living the manna way. And there'll be peace on earth. The day of Shalom will come. And God calls his people to be a light to the nations. So the nations will come. And then from here to look at the New Testament and the coming of Jesus and the witness of the early church in the New Testament as God's work I had a name for this. God's work of, I like this one, reconstituting. God's work of restoring, God's work of renewing, but in a way that is new, of reconstituting ancient and primitive wilderness Israel, of restoring it and renewing it, and then opening it up for all people. Do you see how these are two very different ways? And now we have a New Testament that is in complete harmony with the Hebrew Bible. The vision of the Hebrew Bible, the generations and centuries of the building of a community. And now Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus comes to call Israel and to build a reconstitution of Israel. A renewal of Israel. To do the work of Israel, and that is to, by its life of manna living, to attract the nations of the world, to be a light to the nations, that all the nations may be blessed. Okay. Now, this is A and this is B. I'm going to have a little guess on which one do you think I'm more lean towards? C? I'm just, that was absurd. This is what we're going to look at now. We're going to test this and ask the question of the life and ministry of Jesus. So I'll leave it up. No, I won't. I already started. Now, just going to just share some of the ministry of Jesus coming and the witness of the New Testament. Really start focusing on Luke. And I listen to this preparation now for the coming of Jesus. The witness of John the Baptist. Crowds of people came out to John to be baptized by him. You snakes, he said to them. That's the way to get a sermon started. You snakes, who told you that you could escape from the punishment God is about to send? Do these things that will show that you have turned from your sins. Don't start saying among yourselves that Abraham is your ancestor. I tell you that God can take these rocks and make descendants from Abraham. The axe is ready to cut down the trees at the roots. Every tree that does not bear good fruit will be cut down and thrown in the fire. And then people asked him, what are we to do then? Well, that's when preachers faint. Happens once in a while. Somebody actually comes up and says, what then should we do? Try it sometime. You know, watch your preacher faint. And this is what John the Baptist answered. Whoever has two shirts, give to the one who has none. And whoever has food, the same. You see the vision or the memory of the manna lesson in the wilderness? What was the manna lesson? What did everyone have? Two quarts. Everyone enough. And God provided for all, and all shared. And he says, John, tell us something really exciting to get ready for the Messiah. Really exciting to do. Look at your suitcase. Two shirts. Find someone with none. Same way with food. And right away, the call of John the Baptist is to get ready for the coming of the Messiah. Is to again go back to the wilderness and learn the manna way. It's no accident that where did John the Baptist preach? In the temple court? In the wilderness, the very place where God teaches, the very place where God had the classroom, the schoolroom, where God found the teachable moment and taught the people the lesson of manna in the wilderness. And John, calling the people into the wilderness, is saying, come back to the wilderness, learn the lesson again. And the baptism in the wilderness is like a new Reed Sea event. So now we have the beginning, and then Jesus and his baptism. The announcement by God is that this is my beloved Son now, in whom I am well pleased. By the way, this is the book advertisement, this wonderful little booklet that has all of the Bible passages about hunger and justice. And I've said, don't replace your Bible with this, because it leaves a lot out. But it is a way of... for devotional purposes, to separate and read the parts of the Bible that are focusing on hunger and justice. Then, then when Jesus goes to the synagogue, remember in Nazareth, after his baptism, after his commissioning by God, his ordination. And in a way, this is Jesus saying what his ministry is about. And he unrolls the scroll. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because God has chosen me to bring good news to the poor. What would good news be in the context of the memory of that society? And I ask the question, what would the good news be if it were not the restoration and the reconstitution of Manna's society? He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed, to announce that the time has come when the Lord will save his people, or the acceptable time of the Lord. Many scholars say that's Jubilee language. Remember what we said about Jubilee last time? Every 50 years, the vision, the dream of the covenant was this wonderful Monopoly game where somebody blows the horn in the middle of Monopoly and everybody goes back to go. All land is restored to the original owner. Can you imagine the excitement of the poor people of Nazareth as they heard this announcement? In my coming, the acceptable year, Jubilee year, a new man of society is coming. Oh, the excitement. Until, remember in the text, Jesus announced that this would be for whom besides them? Besides Jewish people. Yeah, all nations. And then they decided to try to throw him off a cliff. But still this wonderful good news of and hope of manna for us, manna society for us. And Jesus had God's vision from Abraham of the blessing to all the nations on the earth. Now, instead of looking at passages, I just feel like I'm saying all these wonderful things, you know. Live in these fantasies, you know. Let's talk about Jesus and first his gathering of this group of disciples and followers. And in Luke, it's more than 12. It's many and includes women. And it includes probably the marginal people, the outcasts, poor people. And my image is that Jesus, in gathering this group around him, is going to teach them as God taught the children of Israel in the wilderness. This is school now again. And this group of people will learn to be a manna society. And how does Jesus teach them? And there's three ways, I think, to focus on the life of Jesus. One is on his eating ministry, the other his forgiving ministry, and his healing ministry. And they're all connected. They're all signs of the kingdom of God. It's the reign of God when it comes. There's a new way of eating together. There's forgiveness for all, and there's healing. But because of manna, I'll concentrate on the eating. Okay? And I'm going to say this, if you want a definition of the life and the ministry of Jesus, just say, eat, 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 eat. Yeah. Wherever he went, he was eating and eating and eating and eating. And he was severely criticized why John the Baptist didn't eat enough. What did they say about Jesus? What did they call him? Glutton. Overeater. And not only that he ate and ate and ate, but with whom did he eat? It was the very people that primitive Israel called the community to have mercy. They got a lot of food and went to the highways and byways, as Jesus instructed the rich to do. And they all came, and there was a manna feast there, God's food for all. And the other way Jesus did this was, remember the times Jesus ate at the home of a rich person? And we forget sometimes that Jesus was a poor person among the poor, and his disciples maybe were poor people. They were ones who did not carry possessions around. They were identified with the poor. Whenever Jesus invited himself to a rich person's dinner party, he was really bringing the poor into the party. Do you get it? And we always think they were probably dressed about the same as the rich, but I kind of doubt it. Then Jesus calls on the rich to invite the poor, the maimed, and the lame, and the blind to dinner. He calls them to be manna people. He calls them to recreate the wilderness. Or the rich young man, sell all you have and give to the poor and follow me. Practice manna living. His dream of the day when all and the Gentiles will share the banquet in the kingdom of God. And Jesus' feeding of the multitudes. Did Jesus go around that crowd and test each one to see who was deserving? Who was worthy of his food? But when Jesus broke the bread and passed it to the multitudes, it was a recreation and the reconstitution of primitive Israel and a reconstitution of the wilderness life. So you see, I'm just going on, eat, 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 eat. And that wonderful story of Zacchaeus. Here's one of your manna hoarders that was causing smelling and maggots. Zacchaeus, up in the tree. Come down, I'm going to your house. And Jesus shares food with him, and by Jesus in the house, Zacchaeus is eating with the representative of the poor. And then in this grace and forgiveness of Jesus eating with Zacchaeus, and thereby accepting him and forgiving him, Zacchaeus cannot wait to jump up and start a redistribution of wealth program. And notice in the story of Zacchaeus, there's no sense of law in this. My goodness, now because I've gotten in touch with this Jesus, I guess I have to give a little money. But he bounces out of the house, the mood is. He can't wait to restore those whom he has cheated. Do you see again how it ties to wilderness, manna, society? And just before the Zacchaeus story, Jesus has opened the eyes of a blind man. And Luke puts that story, I think, there. And then the Zacchaeus story is an example of one whose eyes are opened. And also, Luke puts the Zacchaeus story just before Jesus goes to the cross, maybe as a way of saying, now this is why Jesus dies on the cross, to turn the whole world into Zacchaeus's. You get it? Followers of the manna way. Jesus died for this. And then the resurrection and the Emmaus story, walking with the disciples on the way to Emmaus. And they don't even know who he is until there's food around. Do you get that? He breaks bread and they recognize and they share a meal. And then earlier, the Last Supper that Jesus shared, a manna meal, saying, I will not eat again of this meal until we share it in the kingdom of heaven. And so the Eucharist and the Holy Communion becomes the establishment of a manna meal. Do this in remembrance of me. And they share the bread, and it's like the wilderness again. They share the cup, and it's the wilderness restored. Well, now, tomorrow we're going to ask the question, does the New Testament church try, at least, is it spirited to carry on Jesus' manna ministry. So what I've done today is to try to show that Jesus was in harmony with the dream of the Hebrew Bible, and Jesus was restoring the wilderness manna society to that society, that they could be a light to the nations. I know that's I did this so quickly, but I'm going to stop here and just let you respond now to this way of looking at Jesus and tying Jesus to the Old Testament.
Who wants to respond here?
Is the message of this that our church can become a man of society, or we can try to convert our government to a man of society?
The question is this a call to the church to be a man of society, or is it a call for us to try to make our government a man of society? Could I be real bold and just ask, what do you think?
I'm of the philosophy that I'm an attorney who believes in separation of church and state, and we shouldn't impose our values on the state to some degree. And John didn't say give that shirt to Caesar and let him cut up the slices and give it away. He said to give your shirt, and I have the philosophy that the confessional churches, which we are one, until we do more than we've done, there's, what do we average, 3% giving nationally. We don't have a lot of spirited stewardship sermons, and until we do more, and maybe we should lead by example rather than going and begging them to carry our water.
I wouldn't sit on there.
I'm not going to sit on there.
In any good stewardship drive, you always try to get a couple big donors to make the big first hit. If you've got a big capital campaign for hospital, church, nursing home, you always have a couple big hits. So you've got the thing going, and then you go out and use people given to go out and raise money, and maybe the churches ought to do more in that area before they go. Maybe they should lead by example before they... Now, how many people would have come to church if you preach the society of you've got to give away more of your money? You're piling it up. That doesn't... It doesn't square with what some people perceive as the... But as I think one of the priests said when the Pope came around, he said, we're not called to preach what people want to hear, we're called to preach the gospel.
Before I respond or we have responses, could I just mention what a church stewardship program might look like if it were based on the Hebrew Bible manna wilderness? And then let's not forget the question. You had your hand up there.
I just suspect you would have to start with the man, a person, not a government or a church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me. I want to just say this because as long as the subject came up, and then let's move on. If a stewardship program based on manna would be like this, you'd get a pledge card. Are you ready for this? And a normal pledge card is how much you make, and then the very, very unbiblical idea is immediately planted in your mind that you own it, and now you're making a decision of how much of it to give away. Already, it is completely unbiblical, at least according to me, because it's already making the assumption that you have something that you own, and you're going to make a decision now of what percentage of it to give. And then you make your percentage, and then how much that is each week, and then you give. And we think of how much of what we own then do we give to God. And a biblical stewardship card would begin like this. It would have all of your resources, and then it would say, that is the manna that's fallen in your yard. Then, and this is hard for me because I don't follow it. You know, I'm standing here as a fellow struggler. Is that? Then you would, the next line of the stewardship card would say, how much do you need out of that to live in sufficiency? You know, which would take maybe a month of fervent prayer. What is sufficiency? And then the biblical model would be what is left is what is then joyfully like the grain that is not cut up next to the wall, remember? Not going the second time over the field. What is left then is what's joyfully just thrown as God's manna because it belongs to God. And God has made the promise to open God's hands and satisfy the desire of every living thing. And so then your pledge card then becomes how much of God's manna got stuck in my yard that I get to be the instrument to push it along. Try that one in your in your country. But do you see how that would be a pledge drive that would follow the biblical? And it's for that reason, whenever we have a pledge drive in stewardship drive, until we reach this point, I refuse to call it biblical stewardship. I call it, up until that point, I prefer to call it money-raising technique, which can be worthy, and the church uses that, and maybe in our society we need to, but I think we have to remember to name something what it still is, and that's fundraising. Now, how did I get off?
What does the double tithe mean then? I mean, the 10% tithe. Did that come in a little later in society?
Yeah, you know, it was part of what I called the covenant gift, you know, the wonderful, beautiful life. Were you here the first?
Yes.
And the tithe was to give the first tenth, you know, as a recognition that I own nothing. You know, and I keep year after year remind myself, I own nothing by giving the best and the first to God. Or the New Testament word in Greek that we usually use the word give really means release. You know, it somehow got stuck on me and I release it. Very different than what we think of the word give. But then the tithe, remember, 2 out of the 3 years you went to the temple area and had just a wonderful feast. God says, all I wanted you to do was remember that it belongs to me and you own nothing, so come, let's have a party. And then the third year, it's the releasing of God's manna that got stuck with you, you know, that is more than you need. It's your first tenth, but God is going to provide. The third year, it's for the widow and the orphan and those who do not have enough manna, but God has promised. Then by the tithe, you become the instrument of the release of that manna of God to those people. A wonderful, it's a joyful, and I always want to remind us to say gospel, gospel, gospel. You know, gift, gift, gift. This isn't like, here are the 27 rules for a miserable life, but you got to do it.
I wasn't meaning to say government shouldn't provide. Mm-hmm. I think it's in government's interest to provide. Mm-hmm. It's not because it's Christian, but because, or Hebrew, but because it's, I always feel it isn't worth having a lot if you have to build big gates around your house to keep those that don't have out.
Yeah. That's the stinking. Let's respond to the question, though. Is this really first talking about the church living the manna of life, or is our first task to influence the government to create a manna society for, say, the United States of America? So, finally back to the questions. And Jack, you had a response and a kind of cut.
The manna life begins with the individual, I think. Like this, say, there be peace, let it begin with me.
Mm-hmm. And I think the Hebrew prophets would not separate that from what's also called to the conversion of the community. And then, of course, the individuals in the community. So that would be your first response. It certainly starts with me and starts with us before we are going to try to influence the government. Is that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Part of it is really what we'll be looking at tomorrow, as the early church and how they did this. If I could say this for now, is that I believe that the first call of the Scripture to the community is to be the man of society as an example to the world. And then the vision of the Old Testament is the world is going to come and say, hey, this looks pretty great. Teach us this way. We'd like to run the whole world this way because it's so blessed. And so the first responsibility is that we be and that we become by the power of the Holy Spirit a man of society among ourselves. I've always wondered what the Bible would sound like if it were written to a democracy. To in the American democracy where we have power to influence. And I think when goodness is happening in the whole society and people of faith that have seen the man of vision, their political life is going to encourage this Let me give one example of in our society a way that it is encouraged or discouraged, and it's the whole area of inheritance, and I don't know much, that much about this, but it's the whole area of inheritance tax. Inheritance tax at its best is to limit one little part of society of accumulating wealth over generations and piling it up and piling it up. And inheritance tax is an attempt at that be continually spread more. Which, do you see how that relates to?
Yeah, we have that.
Mm-hmm. And
the last bill reinforced that. The last 86 Act substantially reinforced that redistribution of wealth.
And, you know, I may be wrong. Maybe someone could help me. I've understood during the Reagan years the inheritance tax has been lowered and lowered and lowered. So.
Well, it hasn't. It hasn't. It's gone from a 70% bracket over $10 million down to, it was going to be a 50, but they've held it at a 55. Mm-hmm. But they put in a substantial generation skipping tax so that any gift over and above $1 million per person is subject to a almost confiscatory tax across two generations of about 70%. Mm-hmm. So you're better off just leaving it, except for $1 million. So you can only have $1 million except for the Gallo Amendment, where you can give $2 million to each grandchild before 1989.
Yeah, sure, we're all worried about that.
I'm glad I found out about that.
The Gallo Amendment.
Because
got cheap wine in the tax bill, but so they do, at least the bill is the law as it is now. It's going to be harder. Now, $1 million is a lot of money, but when you start talking about the big families of this world, I mean, if Joe Kennedy would have been inhibited by these restrictions, the current generation of Kennedys wouldn't be living so long. That's the youngest generation now. And I always tell my conservative friends that but for inherited wealth, we have the Kennedys, so what are you worried about? I can look at it this way, because I'm not going to inherit $1 million. I'm not going to be losing sleep, but I think money gets a little constipated when it sits in big trusts forever for people.
And, you know, what I think I would hold up is this being one example of how you know, a Christian community that has caught the vision and been gifted with the vision of man and society, that this would be just one example of its concern then in influencing the political process, which really is us in a way of saying, you know, let's have in our political life, in our voting, the kind of society that has certain breaks on some families accumulating so that we develop into a society of the extremely rich, you know, and the desperate poor. You know, when there is that concern, it is the people who have, partly the people who have the manna vision that are reaching out to advocate for that in the whole society. But I think I agree, and some might argue with me, that the first task is to ask ourselves, but they're also simultaneous, but the first task is to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be a man of family as the Christian Church? Yeah, others. What do you think of Jesus? What do you think of you know, the continuity that I showed with the Hebrew Bible of Jesus as being a Jewish teacher that is deeply concerned about restoring and reconstituting primitive Israel and the Israel of the wilderness, and then calling people into this kind of a wilderness society. Is this new, or is this a wonderful vision? Is this water Jesus down, or... One and then two.
I think it's a helpful vision. I guess it's not particularly new for me. The question that I've had about this all the time is that an argument has been made regarding the Old Testament particularly, and I think also with Jesus, is that it was always a dream to the prophets. It didn't really reach fruition. You even called it a dream at one time in the presentation. It was an Old Testament dream. There's probably not too many examples that we can really, you know, hard evidence that the dream was ever realized. in the society, or at least without maybe very small pockets. So the question is how do we respond to those who would say the dream both in the Old Testament and the dream of Jesus is really talking about the end time or the new heaven or new Jerusalem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my first response would be for us to be careful of going back to the Hebrew Bible and said it really never worked. It was only a dream, because there are positive things you can say. One is the distribution of land that is reported in the Hebrew Bible, where the larger families that would have had the power to take more land took what they needed, and then they distributed land, smaller families with smaller plots of land, so all had enough. Also, the archaeology of primitive Israel, the reports that I have read, the archaeology of that time shows a partnership and an equality. Also, even reflections on the book of Ruth, you know, and the way she was gleaning, you know, showed that the gleaning laws were taken seriously and they were used. So the understanding that gleaning is God's manna for all. There's real argument if the Jubilee ever happened. Yeah. But what I want to say is let's be careful.
Well, you just responded. Yeah. Even Boaz was rich and Ruth was poor, mm-hmm. and they were both Jews or Jews connected. You know, in a real manna society, that wouldn't have been there in the first place.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have needed gleaning laws because everybody would have shared.
Yeah, and if the Jubilee would have been in effect, that would have all changed every 50 years.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, then what was the second?
Well, then the same thing said about Jesus. Oh, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and this has often been an argument. This is really a vision for the second coming. And even, you know, I don't know how correct it is, but like Gerhard Lohfink, a scholar from Germany, has written Jesus and Community, really says partly Augustine's City of God kind of put this vision into heaven or another place. And I don't know how, but somewhere along the line it was understood that this is the vision of heaven, which becomes a neat excuse. And I think we'd respond to that with, of course, the completed shalom manna society, the new creation, the gift of the book of Revelation, a new heaven and new earth, is a gift of the consummation. But part of the joy of being brought into the community of Jesus Christ, who will come again, is to anticipate that coming by working for the kind of society that shalom will be. Now, you know, it's anticipating the coming is living what we dream. You know, don't we all live what we dream? Think of how your dreams set the way you live. And that becomes the call. Bob.
Well, from what you're saying, it's really, when you talk about restoration, reconstitution, it's always a look back. It seems to me the New Testament has also a tremendous look forward. There's a future that's a vision that isn't just a looking back to the reconstituting of what was, but a looking forward to what might be. You can tick off the theologians who are the theologians of the future, so to speak. But their emphasis is that God is pulling us towards a future that God envisions for us that's greater than any past that has ever been experienced. And you think of the Gospel of John, the Epistles of John, for instance, embodying a kind of we do not yet know what things can be. And so I would like to see you balance a look back with a look to the future. And if I can trot out my Seminex experience once more, moving out of a situation into a situation of exile, at first you always kind of look back to what you left and you say, I hope we can get back there, and after all you realize no, you can't go home again, and you have to turn your eyes towards the future rather than keep looking back to see what the possibilities of the new can be. And if you don't do that, you don't have a future to live for. You only have a kind of pining for what was. So how can you balance your looking back with your looking forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm almost uncomfortable sometimes with the word reconstitution of primitive Israel, because it sounds like then Jesus is only trying to restore what was past. And I use that image to say that I really believe that's partly what Jesus was doing, that, you know, something, there was a vision and a dream and a partial reality that happened in the wilderness, happened in primitive Israel, and I'm here to restore it. But to stop there is to, you know, would be to deny that even when you go back there, you meet a people that live a dream of God's future and God's future shalom. So the people of God then become really, don't they, the people that live in between the wonderful memory and the wonderful hope. And they live with the wonderful memory and the wonderful hope. The memory is what sets who the people are. The Exodus really sets their identity and who they are. The wilderness, the Red Sea, the wilderness sets who they are. And then ahead is the wonderful hope of God's promises for this people, for the future. And every time you go back, you meet the future. Wasn't the Holden theme last year, God is the memory of our future? You know, they're completely mixed together. You go as far back as you can go, there's old Abraham with the with the promise, right, of by you will all the nations of the earth be blessed. Well, I mean, how does that fit, you think, that we live in this wonderful tension between a past that sets our identity and a future that calls us?
Well, that's good. I think, you know, the whole concept of the kingdom of God is the already but not yet kind of tension of the way things are and the way things can be shaped by the way things were. Maybe there's other words you can use as well as restoration and reconstitution, all of mm-hmm. which look back to get some future, you know, hope, promise.
Every time I teach this, I get help, you know. Partly I like ours. But I'd like to have words right at that point that would right there balance those. And you know, anybody that can help or think would be, you know.
You asked, what do you think of Jesus? And what comes to mind with me often is how he makes things topsy-turvy. He contradicts what we have come to accept as the assumed wisdom of a society. He just turns that over. And I was thinking about the parable of the talents as one way that he makes topsy-turvy the manna society. And I'm wondering how we, if we would want to, how we might reconcile a parable where the landowner or the father, I've forgotten, comes back and someone who has had a sum of money and not built a pile has that taken away from him. How do we reconcile that with the manna society?
Yeah, there's a sense, and it's in the parables of Jesus coming, you know, and this would be related again, it's not only a renewal and a reconstitution, but it's something completely new. And part of it completely new is the manna in the wilderness was a very careful equality for all. A very careful, you know, two quarts for each person. It's part of the total newness of the kingdom is a God of total surprises that instead of carefully distributed manna is a crazy farmer throwing the seed all over the place. Some seed falls in the good ground and some on the rocks. Crazy.